Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Happy to be here once again on what has turned out to be a blustery night here in the desert. Hard to believe there was ever a time when Area 51 was not a central part of the lore of the desert. Today, it's as much a part of our state as Joshua Trees and Chuckwallas. We've got the country's only official extraterrestrial highway. Runs right past the dirt road entrance, Groom Lake Road, that travels right up to the gate of Area 51. The highway will carry you on into Rachel, Nevada, home to the Little Alien, where all things extraterrestrial and alien are discussed and even are put up for sale in the form of trinkets and souvenirs. You name it. It's up there. Next week, our hometown baseball team kicks off its season, the Las Vegas 51s. And visitors can spend a few hours checking out the Area 51 exhibit inside of our Atomic Testing Museum. Not everyone has one of those in their town, by the way. Nevada has embraced Area 51 in so many ways. And even now, 25 years after Bob Lazar put Area 51 on the map, thousands of people still make the trek out there into the desert to peek up into the skies and see whatever it is that might be flying around out there, man-made or otherwise. So much has been written about Area 51, a.k.a. Dreamland, Groom Lake, the Watertown Strip, the Box, the Ranch. There have been movies about it, TV shows, magazine articles, tabloid stories, ridiculous speculation, and a little bit of informed guesswork. Tonight, we begin with a flat-out gorgeous new entrant into the Area 51 library. Aviation writer Bill Yenny has put together Area 51 Black Jets, a history of the aircraft developed at Groom Lake, America's secret aviation base. And it's a welcome addition, certainly is to my library, a wonderful book that would not have been possible to write 25 years ago, because so much of what's included in this book now was still classified back then, back when I first started chasing this story. Bill is a straight-ahead aviation guy. He's not a UFO chaser, but he knows a good story when he sees one, and this is good stuff. Bill Yenny joins me in just a few minutes to chat about America's best-known secret base, and yes, I know how that sounds. In hour two, we begin a journey into one of the darkest corners of the paranormal world, the subject that many ufologists would rather avoid, I think, but which refuses to cooperate: animal mutilations. The focus has always been on cattle, but if you know the topic, you know that many other animal species have been sliced and diced as well. Thousands and thousands of cases all over the country, in fact, all over the world, always under similar circumstances. Some are done in connection with mysterious lights in the skies, UFOs, if you want to call them that, or mystery helicopters. These phantom surgeons strike in the dead of night. They chop off certain parts, always sort of the same kind of parts, and then they vanish. They leave few clues. There's no blood. There's no tracks. What they do leave behind are plenty of questions for the victimized ranchers and curious people like us. These mutilations are just flat out weird. I mean, they don't make sense. If someone wants to go to the trouble of cutting up a cow like this, why not just snatch it, just haul it away in your mystery helicopter and take it somewhere and cut it up at your convenience rather than leave so much macabre evidence behind? Or is that the whole point of it? To scare the hell out of us, to keep us off balance, wondering if humans might be next on the menu, whether aliens might be responsible, or some satanic cult. Chris O'Brien has been chasing this mystery for a very long time. He's one of a very small, select group of investigators who are known to get their hands dirty and get some dust on their boots. They travel to these mutilation sites, they talk to ranchers, interview lawmen, gain the confidence of the frightened eyewitnesses. It's only predators, the skeptical say. It's coyotes doing this. It's mountain lions. Coyotes that can operate scalpels, I guess. Bobcats who can fly helicopters and wield lasers. Or maybe it's a satanic cult. That's a good one. A cult that is so sneaky and slippery that in all these thousands of cases out there over all these years in the open range and on family farms where, you know, it's quiet and serene and ranchers generally know everything that goes on. They keep an eye on their animals. And in all that, not a single one of these satanic cult members has ever been caught. Not even close. Not one. Not one has ever had their Beelzebub car break down or got their foot caught in a gully or ripped their satanic pants on barbed wire. Not one. Chris O'Brien's been on the trail of the mystery mutilators for decades now. He's finally compiled all of those years of research into a single volume, a comprehensive history of the mutilation phenomena, one that didn't start in the American West and doesn't end here either. The new book is called Stalking the Herd, and it's a compelling, if puzzling, read. Chris will join me in hour two of the program tonight to tell us what he's uncovered and what he thinks is behind this flat-out weird and spooky activity. His colleague David Perkins, who's been at this even longer than Chris has been, will join us later tonight to add his perspective. And I think this is exactly the kind of subject that Coast was created to cover. I hope you'll agree. So put on a pot of Joe, bring in the cat, throw a log on the fire, and slip into those jammies because it's going to be a long and spooky night. A couple of quick news items to mention first, though. Another day without solid answers about the missing Malaysian jetliner. But it seems like they're inching closer to some answers. Searchers spotted items in the Indian Ocean today that could be wreckage. The four pieces they spotted are said to be more than 6 feet long, orange in color. They simply don't know yet for sure whether they're from the missing plane, but 10 planes and 10 ships are involved in the search for debris. And investigators say the discovery of these four orange objects is, quote, one of the most promising leads they've had so far. Up in Washington State, the search continues for bodies in the muck left behind by killer landslide. The death toll now stands at 21. Searchers found four more bodies today, but say the remains are not intact. Another 30 people are listed as missing. Webmaster Lex and I have culled together our usual assortment of oddities and items of interest, all of recent vintage, I might add. We put them together under the banner Naps News and posted it all on the Coast website. Included there tonight are stories that directly relate to our guest this evening. One story about a new TV show about Area 51. One of these days, I give you my take on that project. And an article about a super secretive military unit, maybe the most secretive outfit in the Air Force, except for the flying saucers, we presume. We also posted a piece about the cattle mutilation mystery, or should we call it mutilations? Actually, the idea about what to call it is something we're going to get into in our interview with Chris O'Brien later on tonight. A nice overview piece for you to get into the right frame of mind for our discussion this evening. There's also an update on attempts to blame Edward Snowden for just about everything they can think of. And finally, there's a pretty cool story about a possible hiding place for a great big pile of treasure looted by the Nazis during World War II. Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber, you remember him. He's been my guest on this program a couple of times. He put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience a couple of weeks ago, actually a couple of months now. They had a screening of Barber's terrific and I'd say historic film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. Terrific stuff. It's now out on a DVD, and Lex put a link on our Twitter feed, our Coast Twitter feed. You can find it on the website, along with a lot of other good stuff. So take a peek when you get a minute. We're going to take our first break, and when we come back, the mysterious aircraft of Area 51, Bill Yenny and the Black Jets. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast to Coast. It's been said that Area 51 is sort of like a Rorschach test. You see in it what you want to see. So flying saucer enthusiasts will go out there and see flying saucers when they head out into the desert, and alien hunters see aliens, and aviation enthusiasts look for advanced planes and platforms, and the camo dudes who are out there patrolling the perimeter, they keep an eye out for people just like us. So everyone goes home happy. I started chasing stories about Area 51 back in the mid-80s. My boss and mentor, a guy named Ned Day, was the first reporter in the country to break the story about a secret plane being tested up there, a stealth plane, one that was invisible to radar, which sounded ridiculous almost at the time. Ned got picked up by FBI agents. They hauled him in and put a bright light in his face and kind of threatened him a little bit, but eventually had to cut him loose. Our TV station made Area 51 a priority after that. And then in 1989, along came Bob Lazar. And whatever anonymity Area 51 had was gone forever. A lot of nonsense has been written about the place ever since. But this new book by Bill Yenny is not in that category. It's a marvelous piece of work, and we're happy to welcome Bill to the program. Glad to have you here, Bill.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, and it's really been an honor to have you invite me on.
You have written 36 nonfiction books, a lot. You've been interviewed on the History Channel, National Geographic. You are an aviation guy. You know this stuff backward and forward, and have written about some amazing places and planes. But I would think that Area 51 and the planes that are out there would be like the Holy Grail for guys like you.
Well, yeah, it's an amazing place with a lot of amazing hardware. And it's the kind of thing that aviation guys have known about for a long time. The U-2, the A-12, stealth fighter. Aviation guys know a lot of the details about that, but it's still amazing to me that it's such a mystery to the general public what's going on out there. So what I tried to do in this book was to take all those dots that people may have heard about and connect those dots in a sort of a historic narrative and a history of the programs that were tested out there and how they fit together and how they affected the evolution of aviation. You talk about the stealth aircraft. That was an important turning point in aviation, something that even today is not fully understood by the general public, and tried to put all of this into a single cohesive narrative and illustrate it with a lot of pictures, many of which have not been seen or have been seen very rarely elsewhere.
You know, it was the aviation guys like yourself that first told me about the flying saucer stuff. They were guys like Jim Goodall, who's written about the stealth fighter and stealth bomber, and they would go out there. They had a group called the Interceptors, and they'd go out in the desert long before Bob Lazar came along and sit around and see whatever they could see, trying to spot advanced planes that so they could break the story before anybody else did. And they started telling me about flying saucer rumors and things that would make George Lucas drool, that kind of stuff. And I think you do a really great job in this book of casting for a middle ground, not taking sides, not making too much fun of the flying saucer stuff. But you have to tell the story. You have to include it in any account of Area 51, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. It's part of the story. And it's part of the story, but it's an element that is sort of leaves itself open to the kind of fantasy that I think drifts away from what's really going on out there.
Oh, no question. I mean, I've heard the craziest stories about the place. They're supposedly they take the milk carton kids, all missing children are taken out there, and they take them down to some gigantic vats of human body parts where they're making alien hybrids, and you name it. I mean, but the fact is, the stuff that goes on there that we know about is fantastic enough. You don't need to elaborate.
Well, it's incredible. The stuff that they've tested out there, in recent years, the Tacit Blue and the Bird of Prey, airplanes that they don't tell us about it until they're ready to tell us about it. So I think there's a lot of stories still to be written out there about fantastic stuff that has nothing to do with kidnapped body parts.
And I'll ask you about that. Let's talk about secrecy for a minute. Secrecy, non-secrecy. I mean, seems like they can't make up their minds whether it's a secret place out there or not. A lot of games played over the years. I mean, in my office is a copy of a news release issued in 1955 announcing the creation of a facility out there. It was going to be temporary. They sent it out to KLAS and other media at the time, and everyone for years called it Area 51. It was listed on maps. I've got a couple of them, AEC maps that called it Area 51. I got a phone book from the test site that listed it as Area 51. They had it in a film from Lockheed. And then, as you note in the book, the name started disappearing. In the late 70s, early 80s, it started going away. And then the military seized 89,000 acres of public land to have as a buffer zone illegally. And it was like the cone of silence dropped over the place. They started denying they had a base there. They wouldn't answer questions. What do you make of the back and forth? Because now they admit it's there, but they're trying to say it was never a secret.
Well, that's just foolishness. It was it was there, is there, and it was a secret, and it still is a secret. If you think it's not a secret, take a drive up Groom Lake Road and see how far you get. I've done that. I'm sure you have, too.
Oh, yeah, many times. Would they plant a story about flying saucers as a way to distract attention from something else up there? Because I ask it in this context. As a result of the flying saucer stories, and a lot of people think they were made up to distract attention, as a result of those stories coming out, you know, tens of thousands of people, every media organization in the world has beat a path to Area 51's door. If they didn't want attention, that plan backfired.
Well, I think I think not. I think there was a period in the 1990s when, as you say, everybody did beat a path to the door, and when the news crews went out there and shot a lot of footage, and the footage contained no real flying saucers, they sort of started to drift away. And now what Area 51 is almost a sort of a coven of kooks as far as the general public is concerned. You know, it no longer has that allure that it once did. Now it is sort of written off as a almost a fantasy world.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know which public you're talking about, because I would dispute that. I know what you mean. It has been written off because so much of it has been hyped, but I think there's probably still quite a bit.
I agree with you that there is this wild fascination among people. People who will say that, no, I don't believe in ghosts, but yeah, I do use a nightlight.
Of course, you note in the book that the U2 was the first was sort of what they grabbed that spot in order to fly the U2 out of there, a perfect spot for something like that, right?
Well, that was the idea, to pick a place that was as far from anywhere as possible and far from prying eyes, and they could fly this mysterious airplane that I was just communicating. I've got a page on the Above Top Secret forum, and I was just answering some questions tonight about the U-2 and about how the U-2 was mistaken for a UFO a lot in the 50s because it could fly at 65,000 feet, and airplanes just didn't do that. So pilots who saw these reflected lights at 65,000 feet. But, well, what is this? It's an unidentified flying object, and that was the U-2, and that fueled a lot of the UFO speculation way back then.
I know that's been said, and I know the CIA has said that the U-2 caused a lot of UFO sighting reports. Can you think of any in specific? Because... You know, the U-2 doesn't really look like a flying saucer. UFO,
well,
maybe. I'll tell you what, Bill, that music tells us we'll take a break. We'll get to that question when we come back on the other side. Stay with us, everyone. We're talking with Bill Yenny about Area 51. Much more to come. We're talking with Bill Yenny about the aircraft of Area 51. How much of what goes on out there we really know. When we come back, we'll get into specifics about some of the amazing aircraft that have been announced and maybe a few that haven't. Stay with us. Much more to come on Coast to Coast. Bill Yenny, I don't want to get too far sidetracked from talking about the planes in your book, but before the break, we were mentioning about these reports that the U-2 had been often mistaken. Even most of the UFO sightings had been mistaken for CIA said that, but I don't think that they ever really correlated. Okay, here's the pilot report about a UFO, and that was really a U-2, or did they?
Well, I think if you go through Blue Book, you could probably, and this is something I haven't done, but I think you probably could correlate it to the areas in which the U-2 was flying. It wasn't so much that these guys were looking at a U-2, and we both know what a U-2 looks like, and saying, well, it's saucer shape, which is anything but. I think it was more a matter of looking at the sun glinting off of natural metal up at 65,000 feet. Maybe the U-2 was 20, 30, 50 miles away, and you can still see that up at an aircraft flying at 35,000 feet looking up can certainly see another airplane at that distance. I wouldn't say that it was that U-2s account for most of what's in Blue Book, but I'm saying that those who have theorized this have said that it could certainly account for some of them, which begs the question of what really is an unidentified flying object. And if you look at the analysis in Blue Book and any other, you get somewhere around 85% that are easily identifiable. You know, things that my Aunt Ruth sees a helicopter 20 miles away that she can't hear, but it's a light that floats around in the sky, and you know that gets phoned into Project Blue Book. But it's something that's identifiable. So if you strip away all of that, you have a certain very, very finite number of things that really are not just unidentified, but unidentifiable.
Yeah, I agree with you. In fact, I think it's higher than 85%. I think it's probably 90% or more are identifiable if you have more information. But it's that residue of cases.
Thinking of the ones that are that they identified in those.
Well, anybody who thinks that Blue Book was a scientific study of UFOs is, I don't know. I'd go back to the drawing board on that one.
It was an anecdotal study run by a department in the Air Force that was headed by a captain.
Yeah.
So, and if people think that captains are briefed on things that were as top secret as the U-2 or the SR-71, then that's a big mistake too, because it was a collection of sightings and that were analyzed by people who didn't have a very high security clearance, and it's folklore. It's an archive collection of things that people phoned in.
Or a PR effort, yeah.
I think that if there was something really, I mean, assuming that for a minute that there really was something incredibly conspiratorial and incredibly secret back then, whoever was running it had to have just been overjoyed that the media and the public seized on this idea that these were spaceships from another planet.
Because, oh, sure.
You know, what a fantastic, I mean, you can't make up stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that they're probably true from a PR standpoint. I'm sure they weren't overjoyed when some of these things landed or overflew nuclear missile sites and things like that. But we're getting off the track of your
Yes, we
planes.
are. We are.
Let's talk about the Archangel planes, because this culminates with the SR-71, which I don't know anything close to what you do about planes, but that's got to be the coolest machine ever made by humans.
Oh, it absolutely is. I mean, faster than a speeding bullet. It was the fastest air-breathing aircraft ever. I mean, that family, the Archangel was a series of design studies that came out of the Lockheed Skunk Works, and it culminated in the A-12, which entered production, and it's a single-seat airplane that looks pretty much exactly like an SR-71, which is a two-seat airplane. But the interesting thing about the A-12 was that it was not only secretly tested out at Area 51, they were based there. I mean, that was their home base, and they did overseas deployments to Korea and Southeast Asia, and all run by the CIA. It was an all CIA operation, and then the SR-71 was an aircraft developed from the A-12 that was an all Air Force.
You write in your book about the YF-12. Being one of the great what-if stories, because they could have done all kinds of stuff with that plane that they chose not to do, right?
Yeah, that was the fighter variant of the A-12 SR-71 family, and they built a couple of them. The idea was to develop a Mach 3 interceptor to intercept the fastest possible Soviet bombers. And of course, by that time, the Soviets were moving away, as were we, were moving away from manned bombers to ICBMs. And so the need for a Mach 3 interceptor was sort of fading. But the technology lived on in the SR-71 until the 90s, when the whole program was shut down, and all of these remarkable airplanes, faster than anything that exists today, were just mothballed.
Did the SR-71 ever fly out at Groom Lake? And I ask because in one of the chapters in your book, you describe some witnesses who say, yeah, we saw one take off. And in conversations I've had with the roadrunners who were out there, they said, no, we had A-12s, but they didn't think that the SR-71 had ever flown out there.
Well, it's easy to mistake one for the other. I have seen lots of pictures of A-12s in books, you know, that were captioned SR-71.
Yeah.
The A-12 is just not as well known as the SR-71. So it's, I've heard lots of stories about these things showing up in places where there's no record of them ever having showed up. And I don't discount any of those.
Let's talk about what else is out there. What about Aurora? Your take on Aurora?
Aurora was one of those things that it showed up as a line item in a federal budget, and a lot of times these things are seen not so much of seeing the object is seeing the shadow cast by the object. If you can give that analogy, it's not so much you're seeing it; you're just sort of seeing its effects. And though Aurora was identified by a line item in a budgetary document, and a lot of money was being spent on an airplane that was associated with the name Aurora. And what could this be? People wondered. And there's been speculation that this was the hypersonic follow-on to the SR-71. Many other things. Mainly it was assumed to be an extremely fast reconnaissance airplane.
What's your guess?
I guess my best guess is that it was an R&D program at one time, which may or may not have resulted in flight hardware. This was 20 years ago that it was first being discussed, and nothing has been seen or heard from it since. So it could very well be that it's like we were talking about earlier. It could very well be that this thing has been kept on as a kind of a shroud to hide other things, and over time it has developed this sort of life of its own as a speculative imaginary airplane, and that the speculation and fantasy about it is more real than the airplane itself, which may very well have been canceled 10 years ago.
It's like a unicorn for guys like you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, you were playing the Beatles song earlier, and which reminded me of my own teenagerhood, and I remember in those days being as much of a skeptic as I am today, but I remember carrying my camera around for about 8 months, just waiting for a thing that I could take a picture of. And I would dearly love to see Aurora. I would dearly love to see a saucer. The skeptic in me is the, you know, it's like Harry Truman used to say, I'm from Missouri, you have to show me. Well, I would, you have to show me, but I would really, really like to be shown.
I'm there with you. What about the Black Manta? You know what? If you want a plane that supposedly would look like a UFO, that would be it. Was it ever built?
You know, that's something I can't say that for sure, but there are just too many things. And in the book, I've got some very curious patent drawings, which are absolutely real. I mean, straight out of the patent office, that all kind of point toward it. But again, you know, you're looking at the shadow of the Black Manta, not at the thing itself. And because there is a shadow, there must be something to it. You know, it's just sort of the physics of the thing. There has to be some substance, but it's so hard to tell what the substance really is. You know, some of these speculative theories have become so real and so prominent. You know, are they real, or should the speculation have gone in a different direction? So there's something there, and it's just a matter of finding the evidence which leads you closer to the reality than we are at this point.
Let's talk about what might be out there now. You ever heard any stories about a plane that's invisible, not just invisible to radar, but invisible?
Yes.
You think it's out there, or it's real?
I've heard the stories, and you know, I could make a joke and say that I've never seen it. That's a joke, but and I haven't. But that doesn't mean that I wasn't looking at it, in if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, you're here all week. Try the veal. I know.
Oh, that's the that leads into your next segment. I know. The veal.
Yeah.
I've heard the stories, you know, I can't imagine the physics of the technology. But then, if we were having a conversation about stealth back in the early 70s, and somebody said, "Well, we can make something invisible to radar," well, you know, I don't understand how that could work, but it did, and so knowing that, you can't say, you know, you never say never.
What about drones? What kind of drones might they be working on out there? I you know, we've heard these stories about ones that are the size of insects, but I imagine that
there's those also things exist. There's pictures of those. You know, there's some exciting things going on with drones. I mean, there's DARPA has the Vulture program. Vulture is this gigantic drone that will have the capability of staying aloft for not 6 months, not 2 years, but 5 years.
Oh yeah, you've got a picture of that, don't you?
Yeah,
you've got a picture of that. Yeah,
yeah. And you know, it's very very lightweight, but capability of staying up for 5 years.
Wow.
There's you know, the X-37. That's one to watch.
Yeah.
You talk about black triangles and other things, but watch the X-37. That is, I mean, here you've got a reusable space plane. It has stayed up for more than a year in orbit, returned to a runway landing. I mean, that's just the beginning of a whole new block of technology that a lot of people don't seem to be speculating about yet.
Well, I'm interested in it. What is the mission for that plane, and is there a lot? Is there an Area 51 connection?
There's not an Area 51 connection that I know. The mission of the plane, go back to the X-20 Dinosaur back in the 60s. What was the mission then? It was reconnaissance. It was the potential of a weapons platform. So this thing could be for delivering weapons. It could be for reconnaissance. It's a much more versatile platform than a satellite. That was the whole reason for the SR-71 staying around as long as it did. It's the reason that the U-2 is still around, because these things are more versatile than satellites. And you know, and then to tie that into drones, talk about the Global Hawk. And you know, here you've got a drone that is similar in mission and in mission definition and mission profile to a U-2, but it can stay up for 24 hours plus. I'm wondering why those aren't being used down there in the Indian Ocean. Where are they?
Well, that's
another level of avenue of speculation that nobody seems to be speculating about now.
Why don't we have me figured out how to spot that wreckage yet? Or do you think we could be able to? Do you think they have something that could find it and just haven't?
Yes.
Well.
Yeah, I mean, the Global Hawk has the, you know, they're worried about the P-3s and the P-8s. And the amount of time they can spend over the debris field, or the supposed debris field. You know, Global Hawk could do that. It could go out there and linger for many, many more hours. CIA operates keyhole satellites that, you know, these are the things that, you know, have been reading license plates from space for since the 80s. You know, the KH-11 and the KH-12. They have infinitely better optics than these satellites that have been talked about. So the capability is much superior to what we've been hearing about. I don't know why it hasn't been used. I don't know that it hasn't been used.
I can't understand it either. I would guess that the missing plane could be found with all the stuff we've got up there floating around right now.
It's technically possible. It's just a matter of moving the satellite to that particular piece of the sky, to deploying the Global Hawks to Perth, which apparently they have not done.
I'm sorry to cut you off, Bill, but that the music tells us we're out of time. Bill Yenny is my guest. I really appreciate you coming here. It's a terrific book. It's a beautiful book, Area 51 Black Jets. I recommend people check it out. It's a great addition to anybody's library if you're interested in planes or mysteries. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, sir.
We'll talk to you again sometime. We'll have you back on. Enjoy the conversation. Chris O'Brien and the mutilation mystery coming up next.